started from in early. Good evening, my name is Leanne, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hallelujah.
I'd like to welcome everyone to Simple Actions, a group of Alcoholics Anonymous. For those who care to join, let's open the meeting with the Serenity Prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen.
The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of steps. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. AA Preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And the format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the stuff discussed tonight. So this evening, we are going to discuss the first part of step four. Next week, we'll take care of the second half of step four. And I'd like for y'all to help me welcome Katie and Buster tonight. Tonight, step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, and we're going to start on page 63. So next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action. We're down at the bottom. The first step of which is a personal house clean, which many of us had never attempted. Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. And we're going to start this evening with Buster.
My name is Buster Hawkins, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Buster.
I'm going to qualify myself before we get to talking. I had my last drink April 19, 1992, sitting on the toilet in the bathroom of my mother's house. All the Miller High Life was gone, all the Smirnoff was gone, all the Wild Irish Rose was gone, and all I had left was what was left of a bottle of NyQuil. And it had over 20% alcohol in it. And I drank that cold medicine because I wanted that alcohol and that cold medicine to do for me what all that beer, liquor, and wine had done for me in the past. That's to make me think different about me, think different about you, think different about the world, feel different because I'm selfish and I'm self-centered. How I feel, how I see things, how I see me, how I see you is the most important thing in the world, you know. And my home group is the Suffolk Discussion Group. We meet on Friday nights at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Suffolk. 213 North Main Street, 8 o'clock. It's an open discussion meeting. We'd love to have you there. We do our best to carry out the fifth tradition, to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Open meeting. We don't believe you need to declare yourself to, an alcoholic to come in. We get people from the courts. We get people off the streets. We get people from Western Tidewater Community Services, people who come in there and know they got a problem looking for a solution, people who come in there don't have an idea at all what alcoholism is. You know, so we try to be available to all. If you come there and looking for a solution, we try to offer it. Come there not knowing, not having a clue. We hope you stay. They stay around long enough for us to share a little bit and help them understand what we're doing. I'm grateful that people did that for me because I didn't know. I did not know. I knew I had a terrible problem with alcohol. I'd run people away. I had a lot of things going in my life as a result of my alcoholism. And people like Tom Hearn, my first sponsor, and the people in the room like Tommy D and Maggie and old Howard, the old timers are not with us anymore, helped me understand what alcoholism is and offered me a solution. And I'm so grateful for that. I truly am. And they helped me understand that there was a planned program of recovery to alcoholism, and it's all in this 164 pages of this big book here. And my sponsor gave me this on my third anniversary. You know, it means an awful lot to me. I'm not, because I start talking about Tom right now, I'll probably get a little emotional about it because he passed away some time ago, and with over 27 years of sobriety. And I'm a firm believer in sponsorship, and he was my first sponsor. Tom said, Buster, you do these things, life will get better in spite of you, and he was right. Tom's sponsor was a guy by the name of Earl Felton. Earl died with over 50 years of sobriety. Earl's sponsor was a guy by the name of Sumner Pugh. Sumner Pugh did a lot in this area for Alcoholics Anonymous and had a lot of meetings started as a result of him being involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Sumner's family got tired of him getting drunk, and they didn't know what to do with him, so they sent him to New York to Towns Hospital. And Sumner ran into a guy that became his sponsor, and that was Bill Wilson, our co-founder. And all of us can trace our sponsorship back to, you know, Bill and Dr. Bob. You know, the wonderful program of recovery that two people got together trying to help one another, you know, and I'm so grateful for that. Alcoholics Anonymous has been called the greatest phenomenon of the 20th century. It's all based on one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, you know. The greatest phenomena. And it's all, you know, all based on one alcoholic talking to another. And when Tom introduced me to this program of recovery, he said, Buster, are you willing to go at any length to get sober and stay sober? I said, yes. Had no idea what I was saying yes to. He said, Buster, I want you to be at four meetings a week, two where I am so I could look you in the eyes. And one of them has to be a book study. And I'm so grateful for that, particularly all of that, but particularly that last one, being in a book study, because I love literature-based meetings. This is a planned program of recovery. And part of getting sober for me was become willing to do what he asked me to do. And it says here, liquor was but a symptom we had to get down to causes and conditions. And he helped me understand that the fourth step was a vital part of me getting sober and staying sober. You know, I heard people talking about doing this fourth step. I heard them talking about it was almost like a rite of passage. You know, you had to do this fourth step. You know, people who did it didn't get drunk anymore, and I'd gotten drunk enough. I'd ran so many people away. I'd gone to the hospital too many times to detox. I can't tell you, you know, how many times that I did detox. Some things I can put numbers to, okay? I lost two wives as a result of my drinking, three jobs. I got three DUIs, two in less than 24 hours. Okay, one driving a car through a 7-Eleven window. I can, and as a result of that, another number, they took my driver's license for 10 years. They don't like people doing that, you know, driving cars in the 7-Eleven windows. You know, and I'm so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous and Tom, who helped me to be able to start out on this thing, to put this stuff on paper, to take a good look at me. You know, Dave and Evan were over at my home group Friday night, and we were talking about the kind of life that we get as a result of working these steps and becoming a part of Alcoholics Anonymous and the miracles that occur. You know, Bob from over in Matthews talks about the gifts. And I still look for the gifts as a result of working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I still look for the gifts. I'm going to go home tonight, and I'm going to go next door to my sister. My sister lives next door to me. My nieces all go back to school, back to home in Carolina. But she's there with her, my brother-in-law, and I'm going to go over there, and I'm going to hug the next, and I'm going to tell them I love them. You know, and that is a gift for me. There was a time my family didn't want to be around me. There was a time my family wanted to distance themselves from me because I made a mess of my life. I made a mess of theirs. I hurt them too many times. I gave them too many of them broken promises, you know, them mumbling apologies. You know, I'm not going to do this anymore. Please forgive me. I'm not going to do this anymore. Then I come in the front door, stumble across the coffee table, fall across the sofa, and they get that look in their eyes. Oh, no, he's done it again. You know, I'm grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful for the program of recovery. I'm glad that I had an opportunity to look at me, to be able to sit and put this stuff on paper, you know, and to say, this is me. You know, this is what has been blocked off me from God. You know, I always believed in God. I just didn't pay God any mind. And Alcoholics Anonymous helped me to understand. You know, see, my misconception was, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, these steps and the people in here sharing their experience, strength, and hope, and helped me to understand that believing in God was not the same thing as relying on God. See, I was believing in God and didn't thought I was relying on God. But I was believing in God and relying on Buster, and that don't work. You know, that's why I'm sitting here tonight. That don't work. You know. So I started down this inventory. I remember writing all this stuff down. I remember seeing Tom at meetings. I remember it started to get real big. I was at Legal Pad, and I'd tear the sheet off every time I fill out a sheet. I'd tear another sheet off, and I put it down with all the stuff I'd written down. And I had this big old furniture rubber band that I kept wrapping it up and kept wrapping it up, and I stuffed it in my shirt because I didn't want anybody to see it. And when I got home, I put it under the mattress because I didn't want anybody to see it. All this bad stuff about me, you know, that I needed to get out and to talk to someone about. That I was told that if I did that, you know, that things would get better for me, and it would take those things that were blocking me off from God, and allow me to develop that relationship that this program has allowed me to develop, and that's all I've got. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. My name is Katie. I'm an alcoholic. My gosh, to follow that is going to be a big feat. I'll tell you that. But I am truly grateful that that no matter what, every time I show up in Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody shows me what to do. And you just did that for me. Mm-hmm. And the last drink that I had was August 2nd, 1993. And my home group is over in Hampton. It is the Big Book Topic. And we meet on Fridays and Tuesdays, Friday night at 7 o'clock and Tuesdays at 8 o'clock. We have a beginner's meeting on Tuesday. So if you're ever over in the area, please stop in and see us. I was sitting here thinking about one alcoholic helping another and a moral inventory. When I first got sober, and they talked about a moral inventory, it would almost make me want to get sick because I thought all the bad stuff that I had done in my mind, I had done all these bad things, and how could I ever tell another human being, let alone put it down on paper? And where it talks about here, it says, so we had to get down to the cause and condition, is how could I face that? Because the pain was so great, I would just try to drink it away. I mean, I would drink that booze so quickly to try to forget everything that I was thinking about because my mind raced uncontrollably. And for a very, very long time, liquor would do that for me. It would just take that racing away from me, and I could have some ease and comfort, because when I was restless, irritable, and discontent, that's the only thing that would stop that insanity in my mind. And to actually sit down and think about what causes me to do these things and the conditions that I put myself in was just, that blew my mind. How does anybody take a moral inventory of themselves? And why would they want to, you know? And so liquor was the solution to my problem, and in this paragraph it's telling me that liquor was but a symptom to what really was going on with me. And as it says, as it was read, is one alcoholic helping another alcoholic. When we did our prayer at the before we began this meeting, I came out and I saw my sponsor's husband. I went over and said, what are you doing here? He says, we're here to see if you tell the truth. I said, how would you know? How would you know if I'm telling the truth or not? And he said, she would know. because she was the one that showed me what it was like to actually get sober. I'm the gal that came in to Alcoholics Anonymous because I was so sick, and I didn't want to drink anymore, and I didn't know how not to drink. When I got here, you know, I brought myself with me, and I wanted to party right here in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did that for a while. You know, I would smoke cigarettes and get loud and drink a lot of coffee and get up in the middle of the meetings and go outside and bring people with me. You know, come on, let's go outside and let's just have a good time. And the old timers were not very keen on that. You know, I had been told not to do that any longer. So I tried to behave, and I was incapable of behaving. And so I just did what I did in Alcoholics Anonymous. And for a very long time, I wasn't getting honest. And I wasn't living a life on any principles. And when I got here, you know, you guys were talking about principles, and I thought to myself, what is a principle? I had no idea what they were. When I got here, I didn't know how to pray. They would say, get down on your knees and ask God to remove the desire and the obsession. And that's all I could do because I couldn't remember any prayers from my childhood. And eventually that desire and that obsession was removed from me. And things got a little clearer, and I was separated from alcohol for a while. And because I wasn't doing anything, I wasn't following any principles, and I wasn't living it by the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was showing up here, and you guys would look at me, and you would just say, keep coming back, Katie. And I would say, I will, you know. And so at 12 years, I wanted a drink. Oh, my God, did I want a drink. I wanted to drink badly because all I did was I asked God in my life and he became my creator, and then I was separated from alcohol, and then that was it, and then I just headed into life. And at 12 years when I wanted to drink, I was suffering badly from untreated alcoholism. And then I met this woman who at that very moment became very willing to help me when I asked her to help me. And what she did is she showed me how to get sober, like it talks about in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says we show people how we get sober, we don't tell them. And that's exactly what she did. I would show up at her house, and I would be insane, and I just wanted to run at the mouth, and she would look at me, and she'd say, would you like cream in your coffee? And I would say, yes. And she would put cream in my coffee. And then we would start, we would pray, and then we would start to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous together. And what that did, it gave me hope, that there was hope, that I was insane, but there was hope right here in the pages of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when we got in her living room and we got down on our knees and we did our third step together, and we did the third step prayer, I felt something at once, just like it says in the sentence. If you do this without reservation, you're going to feel something at once. And after 12 years without a drink, I felt something at once. And then we started immediately into action. And I immediately got a piece of paper and a pen, and I started to write down exactly who I was resentful at. Because I had no idea that resentments had the power to kill me. Whether they were real or fancy, I had no idea that they were killing me. Even though I thought about them constantly, and my mind went back to the racing constantly, I had no idea that they were actually killing me, mind, body, and spirit. Because by this time I had no relationship with God, who is the power greater than myself, and I had no relationship with other people. My relationships were slowly dissipating. My life was falling apart, and I really wanted to go to a mental institution, and I had no idea that the deal was right here. I had no idea until somebody showed me how to do that. And when I started to write down my resentments, and I got to see the cause and conditions, the desire again was removed for me for alcohol. That was amazing to me, that one person helping another person get sober without a drink was amazing to me. And that's, I'll pass.
Thank you. So on page 64, therefore we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and a fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock and trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods. to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup, which caused our failure. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations.
As I stated before, I got with Tom, and Tom had showed me what I needed to do. And I love Tom, and Tom insisted that I become part of Alcoholics Anonymous too, because he was very active. He was adamant about that, and I wanted to get in his back pocket. And he helped me understand what this process was. And I wrote and I wrote and I wrote. I put down just as the book shows here. And I wrote and I wrote. Did the columns. Did what I needed to do. And I'd go to meetings, and I'd take that wad out from underneath my shirt, and I'd unfold it and show it to him, and he'd laugh, and he'd scratch out something, he'd laugh and scratch out something, and then offer some comments about what he thought I might need to look at. And I'd wrap it back up, put the rubber band back around it, put it in my shirt, and get back in the car. I mean, go to the meeting and get back in the car. My brother was driving at that time because I didn't have a driver's license, and go home. And I did my best to do it as best I could. And I had a dear friend, Wallace, who was a big book thumper, and Tom sponsored Wallace. And Wallace, I say this often, I got triple teamed. You know, I had Tom, I had Wallace, and I had Frank. Frank's my sponsor today. Frank became my sponsor when Tom passed away, the day of his funeral, as a matter of fact. And Wallace said, "Why don't you look at this?" And Wallace showed me a few things that he had done. And of course, I had permission from Tom to get Wallace to help me. And I got all this down on paper. And then I got with Tom, and we decided when we were going to do the fifth step. And I'll get to that a little bit later on, because that was to look at myself, to be able to do this process and get it down on paper was really revealing to me. I always thought I was a pretty nice guy. And I was. I just did some things that I wasn't aware of, and putting it down on paper like this made me aware of what it was that I had done. You know, what the self manifests itself in so many ways, as we're going to get into in just a minute. But to get it out, I heard somebody ask me, so why do you have to put it on paper? Because when it's rolling around up here, it's not very clear. And he said, what's the magic about that? But the magic does happen, because I got an opportunity to look, and it's there. It came from me. I put it down there. I'm discussing it with Tom. And it's real about me. And that started the process. Thank you.
Thank you. Every time that I've done inventory, I've written inventory, the same common manifestation is that I always want something from somebody or something. And I thought that was a pretty cool thing, you know, because I'm a hustler. You know, I want something from you and I'm going to get it. And so I thought that was a saleable good, not an unsaleable good. You know, I thought that was a good thing, you know, because, if I got what I wanted when I wanted it. And and in my mind, in my thinking process, I wasn't hurting anybody, you know. And when it became that fact-finding, fact-facing process, when it was said, we're going to talk about resentments, I didn't understand that. But when we put it in a business term, as we're going to do a fact-finding process, it became a little bit clearer about the truth. Maybe it's not so bad. I had to discover the truth about myself. And so even though my resentments and my fears and everything are fancy, or whether they're real, they always seem to be real to me. So when I put all these things down on paper, before I put these things down on paper, I didn't think I was that bad of a gal. But when I got here, you know, I hustled myself right out on the street because I was homeless, and I came and walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous with a black trash bag full of clothes. I was telling somebody the other day that when my family would see black trash bags by the door, they would say, oh, Katie's home. She must be visiting. She's back. You know, and that's how I live my life. And I thought that was okay. When I first got here, there was this gal at this meeting in Hampton, and she said to me for the very first time, are you powerless over alcohol? And I said, yeah. She said, "Is your life unmanageable?" And I said, "Absolutely not." And meanwhile, I know where to live. But in my mind, I could manage my life. I could hustle the next game. And so I thought that that was an asset and not a liability. That here we're not here to, once I did that third step, I'm not here to get anything anymore. I'm here to give today. And by God, when I ask him, I get to serve today, which is a cool thing. And it happened as a direct result of inventory and trying to make things right.
Yeah.
Thank you. So still on page 64. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease, for we have not been only mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. We asked ourselves why we were angry. In most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So we were sore, we were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal or sex relations, which had been interfered with?
Yeah, you know, I had to have an interpreter when I, you know, that's what my sponsor did for me. He said, "Pastor, just read the black. Don't put anything in between the lines. Read the black and try to understand." Well, you got to understand, when I came here, it was hard. Y'all spoke in a different language. And I thought, for example, you know, I come here and Tom said, "Pastor, you know, don't make any major decisions your first year," and then I get in the parking lot and somebody, before I get into the meeting, will say, "Buster, remember, you got to change all people, places, and things." You know, it's real confusing. And then compare. We don't want you to compare, but we want you to identify. Now, how do I do that? You know? And here's one. I want you to roll this around in your head a little bit. This is an honest program. To thine own self be true. And then my brother would wait in the parking lot for me, and I'd walk out and go down the steps and get ready to get in his car. And somebody would say, "Buster, don't forget, fake it till you make it." So I really needed an interpreter. And I thought I knew what a resentment was. You know, I knew what a grudge was. But Tom helped me to understand. Tom and Wallace both helped me understand that resentment means to rethink and refeel, you know, that it's still there. And like my old friend, Joel from the Southside meeting in Suffolk talks about like an old dog with a bone, and he buries it, and then, you know, a little bit later on, in a couple few days, he goes back and digs it back up and chews on it a little bit more, and then buries it and goes back, you know, 3 or 4 days later and digs it back up and chews on it. That, you know, that helped me to understand, you know, what a resentment was. And my dear friend Wallace R. From Carolina always talked about resentment and anger, and he said, "For me to get angry, for me to get resentful at somebody, it's like me taking poison trying to kill them, you know?" And I understood that kind of language, you know? And, you know, resentment for me, I had to list all these things, and I had to understand what, and I'm like her, you know, is people weren't going to go the way I wanted them to. Like Tim said, people don't go by my rules, and I'd get upset with it, you know? Life wouldn't happen the way I thought it should happen because of them or whatever. And I would get upset with them because it interfered with my pride, you know, self-esteem and pride. I got to understand that self-esteem is what I think about me, and pride is how you think about me, you know. And I had to understand these kind of things. I listed all these things down. I did just like the book said. I had my grudge list. Now let me tell you about this. A prime example of me getting resentful. I used to work at the city of Suffolk many years ago, and I was a department head, and each year I had to come up with my budget, and I worked real hard on it. I cut it real lean, you know, my operational budget plus my capital improvements budget. I mean, I really put a lot of effort into it and took a lot of pride in it, you know, the way it was done. So I show up at the finance committee, and the budget director's there, the finance director's there, the assistant city manager's there, the assistant to the city manager is there. And I start presenting my budget. Now, it takes several hours to present it. And it was, I thought, a good budget. And the assistant city manager kept raising his hand and asking questions about it. He was cutting it up. He was really, really beating it down. And I was taking offense to it. And I kept presenting it. I kept justifying my numbers. I kept having to go back and cite figures and facts from the previous year and previous year before that, and to justify what I had put on paper for my budget for the upcoming year for my department. And he kept, long story short, as a result of him, all the queries, all the problems he had with my numbers and my proposals, they didn't accept my budget that time. And I'm here to tell you, I left there and I was upset and I was fuming. And I got home that night, and I'll tell you right now, by the time I got to the ninth beer, I called him everything but a child of God. You know, that's, I drank it, people. I drank it then. I drank it, those kind of things. But, you know, I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have this process where I can set these kind of things down and look at it. And, you know, and I can see, you know, that, you know, the self, the things that were the cause of it, you know, and it's a process I can use now, still use now. And if I do this kind of inventory and look at I'm resentful at and what's the cause, and a lot of times if I discuss it with my sponsor and he said, well, you know, this is the way I see it, and then we come up with the fact that maybe it wasn't a real specific cause for that resentment, but just my failure to accept people and situations and things that just as it is, you know. And so this, you know, I'll tell you another thing, too, I found out as a result of me doing this inventory and looking at my resentments. I found out I had some strange mental powers, you know. I really did, because I got resentful at what people were thinking. And, I mean, a police car drove by in the middle of Suffolk one day, and I'm walking downtown, and I saw the policeman look at me, and I thought, I just knew what he was thinking about. You know, there's that drunk buster, and he's walking down the street, and he worked with my stepson. My stepson was on the police department. And I just know he's going to go back and tell him that he saw me walking down the street, and I'm up to no good, you know. ESP, a strange mental power. I could resent what they were thinking about. And that's stupid, but that's just the way it was, you know. And so I'm grateful for this process, you know. You know, pride is what I think you think of me. Self-esteem is what I think of me. You know, like my good friend Scott talks about, says, we want to look good, you know. And when you interfere with that, I get resentful. Thank you.
Thanks. When I'm not honest with myself, or when I'm not picking up the phone and being honest about what is really going on and what my thinking is, what's happening with my thinking, my mind races uncontrollably, and I'm the kind of gal who is always one resentment and one judgment from walking out the door of Alcoholics Anonymous or wherever I am. And when I get to practice the 10th or 11th step and talk about my resentments, because I can get resentful every day and you don't even have to say anything to me. You can look at me in a nice way and I'm going to get resentful at you. You know, and I'll get these ideas about what Buster was talking about, like, what are you thinking about me? What are you saying about, are you talking about me? I've called people and said, are you talking about me? And they go, no, Katie. Well, I did say this about you. And I went, oh, okay. You know, and that is my thinking. That is how my thinking works. And when I get to talk to another alcoholic who thinks like that and we laugh, it just eases that insanity in my mind, you know. And the promise here where it says, when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. Wow. You know, I have been so insane at times. And wanted to be committed to a mental institution that I could have never dreamed to straighten out mentally and physically. But it does happen, and I've experienced that, where the insanity is so strong that I can't even get up out of bed, that I'm so sick that my muscles hurt. But it says right here that I can straighten out as a direct result of practicing this step, that I get to share this with another human being. when I write these things down on paper. It's just an exercise. That's what I was told. It's just an exercise. Just write it down. And so I began to write them down. I wrote down people, institutions, and principles who I was very, very angry with. And it always affects my self-esteem and my pocketbook ambition and personal, most importantly, my personal relationships. And the majority of the time, they don't even know that it's going on. I just cut them out of my life. You know, I'll just cut you out. And you have no idea what hit you. That is the kind of alcoholic of thinking that I have. My alcoholism can take me there. And I truly can say this, is that you had shared at the beginning of the meeting, you had opened it up with effective sponsorship. And I used to hate that. Ugh, effective. Ugh. But truly, I have this woman in my life who I left because I cut her out of my life. I was mad at her. And I went back to her because she is effective for me. She works for me, you know. And I am truly grateful for that, that I can call her with a resentment because I wanted to kick somebody's butt one day. And she said, do you have your boots on? And I said, no. And she said, well, if you go home and put your boots on and you still want to kick their butt, then you just go right ahead and do it. And we just laugh. That's the insanity of those silly resentments that I get in my mind. And I need somebody to say, let's think this way for a moment, because I can't change my thinking the majority of the time by myself. Thanks.
Okay, on page 65, we went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. The first thing apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. To conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse and then we were sore ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived.
To conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. I was told I had to let that go. You know, there's a line in the 12 and 12 says, we triumphantly seize upon the misdeeds of others as a perfect excuse to minimize or forget our own. And that was me. And also, the more I thought about it, you know, if I had a resentment against somebody and I'm trying to inventory it, a lot of times, you know, I would think about it, and that's, thank God for sponsorship. I think about it, and the more I thought about it, their part got bigger and mine got smaller, you know. But once I got honest and realized that I had to look at my part and not theirs, you know, and got it down on paper and talked it over with Tom and work it out and see what it is about me that was out of sorts, you know. What did I do that made them do what they did that makes me feel the way I feel, you know? And I had to look at me, you know? And I also found out that resentments gave me a strong sense of spirit superiority sometimes, because it allowed me to feel, you know, how dare they do that to me? I would not do that to them, you know? How dare they? And particularly with family. And I'll give an example. My wife, who is now my ex-wife, a lovely lady, a beautiful lady, and I had to put up with a lot because of my alcoholism and my drinking. I came home one night and feeling amorous, and I go into the living room and she's sitting on the couch. She's very tired, and I put my arm around. Anyhow, long story short, she didn't feel the same way. She was tired. And so she went up the stairs and went to bed. So I poked my lips out and thought to myself, you know, I for about 2 or 3 days I walked around, my lips poked out. How dare you do that? You know, I wouldn't do it to you. Strong sense of superiority. And to be able to look back on these things and see just how foolish and self-centered I was to have those kind of, feelings. Really, to be able to look at me and be able to rectify these things and to be aware of them today and realize that it's not all about me. Thank you.
Thank you. What this paragraph looked like for me was it was twofold. As I remember at a very early age, before I had consumed alcohol, that I would walk around thinking about what others had done to me, and that everything was their fault. And poor me. And how do people just treat me like this? I'm just such a soft little girl. And then once I put that booze inside me, you know, all bets was off. I mean, it was like, forget it. I don't need you. You'll never do that to me again. You know, so the cockiness and the sureness, just really, my ego just manifested into this massive wanting to be the general manager of the universe, as a direct result of thinking that you did me wrong. And maybe you did, I don't know. But I carried that for a very, very long time, way, way into my alcoholism. And it kept me drunk for a very, very long time. And it seemed like I was winning. Like, I'll show you how drunk I can get and curse you and you not even be there, you know. And I thought I had triumphed. I drank very heavily for 8 years. That was, it was very short-lived. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, page 66. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? But with the alcoholic, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns, and we drink again. And with us, to drink is to die. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison.
They really are. When I joined my home group Friday night, I had lost my driver's license. I had lost my job. Anyhow, I'd gotten a job working at a small furniture store down on Washington Street, and they gave me the key to the church, and I would open up on Friday nights. And it was one Friday, and I was really upset. I was really upset with the owner of the company because he intimated that he would was going to fire me. Now, he, without going into detail, he had some illnesses going on, too, that affected the way he talked to people, treated people. He was manic, depressive, and a lot of times when he was off his medicines, he would say things, do things that he really didn't mean. But I was upset because, you know, here I was. I'd lost everything, basically, and I'd got an opportunity to work down there. And yeah, for minimum wage. You know, I'd gone from a job that I had 33 employees, a nice contract with bonus provisions and stock and the whole nine yards, and I lost all that because of my drinking and went to work for him for minimum wage. Grateful to get it, too. Grateful to get it. And I didn't have a driver's license, so I walked from the furniture store to my home group, opened up, make coffee. And Wallace came in, and he could tell that I was upset. And he could tell. I said, "Well, Wallace, this is what happened." And I shared with him that I was afraid, I was scared, I was mad, I was angry at him because of what he had said, what he had done. And Wallace grinned, went over and got the big book, turned to this page in here, and then pointed to the prayer that's on the next page. "God, save me from anger, thy will be done. How, you know, how can I help this sick person?" You know, and I'll never forget it. And like I said, my dear friend Wallace Arler from Carolina, I always talked about anger being, you know, that dubious luxury, and being the fact that me trying to take poison to kill somebody else, you know, and I understand that. I understand it today. And, you know, and Dr. Bob's got a prayer, or had a prayer on his desk, and I think a lot of people here are familiar with it, about humility being, you know, perpetual quietness of heart, is to have no trouble, never to be angry, irritable. And that, and when I get to that point in that prayer, I stop, because, you know I'm going to foul up today somewhere, you know. And I got to be mindful of that, because I might not show it. I might not let the individual know that I'm upset with them. You know, I mean, customer, I'm a salesperson. I see people on a regular basis every day. And not everybody that comes in that store goes by my rules, you know, and that's okay, you know. And I accept them for, as best I can for what's going on at that point in time. But, you know, I use that prayer, thy will not mine be done, a lot during the day. When, in particular, I'm dealing with a very difficult person. That and it may not be difficult for them, but it's difficult for me because they may be wanting something that I can't provide. They may want a solution to a problem that I can't provide that. Or they may be looking for a piece of furniture or whatever that I can't provide. And some people are not as patient as all of us in this room tonight. And I might not be the only one that thinks that. But, you know, and, you know, it gives me an opportunity to slow. What that prayer does for me, you know, thy will, not mine be done, it slows my brain down long enough to keep my mouth from going in gear. And I'm grateful for that. Thank you.
For me, I know in my mind, body, and spirit that this is the only deal that works for me. This is the only solution that works, that can keep me close to my Creator and close to other human beings, and that I can live life without wanting to drink or die. And yet, I'm the kind of gal that wants to leave a lot, and I have. I walked away from Alcoholics Anonymous. I think I was 9 years sober, and I thought, "How you guys keep doing the same thing? You know, get a life, and I'm going to go out and live my life." And so I walked away from Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started going to church. And I didn't practice anything there, and I would show up every once in a while. To try to get something or to see who was here. And I would bring my highlighters with my big book to big book meetings, and I would highlight so that you would think that I knew what I was doing, and I had no idea what I was doing. And if you would have asked me how to get sober, I would have probably, if you would have called me, I would have put you right into voicemail because I wouldn't have known what to say to you. And yet I was dying from deep resentments. I was dying from them. And through the effect of this process, I got to straighten out mentally and physically as a direct result of doing this, because I continuously can shut myself off from the sunlight of the Spirit. And at 12 years, the insanity of alcohol returned, and I did want to drink again. And it was only by God's grace and mercy that I didn't drink again, because I knew that I was alcoholic and I couldn't drink. And I was too much of a coward. I didn't want to kill myself, but I was dying inside. And this is the only answer for me. And I got to find out how fatal resentments, deep resentments were. And I didn't even know I had deep, rooted deeply inside me resentments. I can get general resentments every day. But these deep, deep resentments have the actual power to kill me. And over the last year, a year and a half, these people have come into my life. And there is no way that people can tell me you're wrong. You know, I can take it a little bit better than I used to. But when I first got sober, if you would have said you're wrong and this is wrong and this is how you need to live your life, I would have said we're not gonna be friends. And what I have gotten to see over the last year and a half are these alcoholics, active alcoholics, come in my life. And I get to sit across the table from them, and they're dying of alcoholism, and they're telling me, she did this to me, and I take a drink, and they did that to me, and I take a drink, and that's me sitting at that table. That's me sitting at that table. And every day I say, God, why do you keep bringing these people in my life? I don't want to do this. I do not want to do this. But it has been vital for my recovery to see these people every single day and to be helpful to them. And I will call my sponsor and I say, oh my God, I can't take it. And she said, well, give them something to eat. I'm like, oh, I don't want to feed them. I don't want to sit there. I don't want to look at them. But what I get to see is myself, and I get to see them drink over deep resentments. And that is me. And right here is the solution.
Right, I'm going to read the last couple of paragraphs, and then if y'all want to comment for just a few minutes each, and then we'll wrap it up.
Okay.
On page 66, we turn back to the list for it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. This was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. We asked God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, "This is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God save me from being angry. Thy will be done." We avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. Referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly, and were willing to set these numbers straight.
I've got a friend in Suffolk, and John and Steve and Chris probably know what I'm talking about, but he said he thought it ought to be like a step 14 where you could slap somebody. No, it don't work that way for it. Don't work that way. You know, I got a wonderful education from Tom and Hilda. I rode with Tom and Hilda to many meetings. I didn't have my driver's license. Tom was my sponsor. And I'm very active in Alcoholics Anonymous, as I've already explained. And Hilda was his wife, lovely wife, just an angel, and helped so many people. She hit a family services over at Merview Hospital for quite some time. And I'd ride with them to meetings and to conferences, and I'd sit in that back seat, and I'd listen to them having those AA and Al-Anon clearing-the-air conversations. Mm-hmm. And Hilda would often say that she gave Tom the right to his wrong opinion. So I learned from that. I also give people to their right to their own opinion, right or wrong. You know, it's not up to me. I try my best. You know, I use that prayer all the time. Love and tolerance is our code. I found that out as a result of working the steps of leaders in the 10th step. But love and tolerance is our code. And people, like Tim said, I sat there one Wednesday night, and Tim said something in the Southside meeting that has really stuck with me. He said, "Buster, not everybody goes by my rules. You know, live and let live." And I'm so grateful to be able to sit there and be able to hear these kind of things. That I can look at Keith, and the first thing I think of is keep it simple. Like the people in the program, Arthur, one day at a time. All I got to do is look at him one day at a time, just by sitting in the room and look at the people, you know, that are active in Alcoholics Anonymous. But Tim said, people don't go by my rules, and people don't. People don't go by my rules. And, you know, a lot of times if I can't reconcile with it, you know, what's going on, then it's my failure to accept, you know, people as to what they are and who they are and how they're living their lives or, you know, how, whatever. I don't have any say-so, you know. And I pray for a lot of people on a daily basis. I can tell you that right now. And that, again, let me emphasize, thy will not mine be done. Slows my brain down long enough to keep my mouth from going in gear. Mm-hmm. You know, thy will not mine be done. Thank you.
Thank you.
I would like to wish them away a lot of the time. You know, oh gosh, I wish this would go away. Just like I did my alcohol. I didn't know how to get rid of, I didn't know how to stop drinking. And I certainly did not know how to do an inventory. And I didn't know how to do one for a very long time. Um, The very first time that I did a thorough inventory, and when I got to where were we to blame, as I was looking at myself, where am I at fault? I think was the very first time. I would have told you that I hold myself in high esteem, and I do everything, you know, I pay my bills on time, and you know, I take care of my kids appropriately, and I take care of my home, and I do this and I do that, but that wasn't the truth. And for the very first time that I did a thorough inventory and I got to that question, where was I to blame, was the very first time I believe that I got honest and I took responsibility and became accountability for my resentments and my thinking and became willing to make things right. Because all my life I'm always out to get something, and when it came to an apology, it was, I'm sorry, you know, I'm sorry. Just, and in my mind, it's like, get over it. Let's just get over it and get on to the next thing. And when I became to set these matters straight, to ask somebody how I can make things right, was a whole new idea for me. Because really, that's where I got sober, was in the second step, where it asks me to lay aside my prejudice because I have all these old ideas. And when I become willing to set aside what I think I know about anything in my life, then I do have a new experience, and then I do open myself up to the Spirit. And then I can have peace, and I can sit across the table from you and be exactly who I am. Because all my life, I am this actor, and I can be this actor today. And to just have ease and comfort is truly a gift without alcohol. When I get to sit down with somebody and do this deal, it's an experience that I'm glad I don't miss. Thanks.
May I say one more? You know, being able to do this process and be able to take a look at me, you know, fear dominated my life, and, you know, selfish, self-seeking, frightened. My fifth step showed that I worried a lot, you know, and I'm grateful that this process was available to me to sit down and understand why I was upset with somebody, you know, what it was about me that caused me to feel the way that I was feeling. And I may have read this before, but I've got something in my pocket that I read occasionally. Would you mind if I read that? And it helps me. It's very powerful. And I get to myself, because it goes right along with resentment here. And you see, I've had several of these in my pocket. I carry it in my left pocket, and I have been for several years. This one's got a lot of notes on it. But it says, people are often unreasonable, illogical, and self-centered. Forgive them anyway. If you're kind, people accuse you of selfish, ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. If you are successful, you will win some false friends and some true enemies. Succeed anyway. If you're honest and frank, people may cheat you. Be honest and frank anyway. What you spend years building, someone could destroy overnight. Build anyway. If you find serenity and happiness, they may be jealous. Be happy anyway. The good you do today, people will often forget tomorrow. Do good anyway. Give the world the best you have, and it may never be enough. Give the world the best you've got anyway. You see, in the final analysis, is between you and God. It was never between you and them anyway. Mm. And Bill said, be quick to see where religious people were right and make use of what they had to offer. And that was by Mother Teresa. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to pass the Seventh Tradition basket here. The Seventh Tradition states that every day a group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the Seventh Tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. And next Monday, we'll continue on with the fourth step. We'll be looking at the fear inventory and the sex inventory. Tonight, we did the resentment inventory. And in between that, this group, this Friday night And Saturday is going to have a weekend of Simply the Steps. We have Bill D and Valerie D from Richmond, Virginia, and Bill's from Las Vegas. And they're going to take us through steps 1 and 2 on Friday night from 6:30 to 9:30. And on Saturday, starting at 9 in the morning, they're going to take us through the rest of the steps, and we'll adjourn at 2:30. And in the middle, we'll have a potluck lunch. So bring a dish if you wish. And that will be right here in this very room this Friday night and Saturday. And there are yellow flyers over there on the literature table. Please take them after tonight. we won't be having another meeting here until Friday, so please take these with you and pass them out. Are there any other AA-related announcements? Okay. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, will you raise your hand? So feel free to see one of us after the meeting if you're looking for a home group. Newcomers, is there anyone here that's in their first 30 days tonight that would like to introduce themselves by their first name?
Hi, David.
Welcome.
Hi, Victoria.
Welcome.
My name is Matt.
Hi, Matt.
Welcome.
Hey,
welcome.
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 Hi.
Welcome.
Hey, John Paul.
Welcome.
Hey, Garrett.
Welcome.
Hey, Garrett.
Welcome.
Hi. Hey, Tim.
Hi, Sheila.
Hey, Sheila.
Hey, Sheila.
We have the literature table I mentioned just a few minutes ago. Please see any home group member after the meeting if you're interested in literature. Books have a small fee. Pamphlets are free. Sponsorship. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise your hand. Okay. And if you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship in AA, we have Ryan and David. If y'all will raise your hands, Ryan in the back, the lady, and David here, and they'll be up here to answer questions on sponsorship. And please feel free to talk to them after the meeting. Smokers, please use the butt cam provided outside. Stay well away from the church doors as we're sharing the church tonight with other members of the church. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. If you'd like to be included in our email listing, you can sign up for that on the website, and we'll shoot you out an email when we have upcoming events. And also, all of our meetings here are recorded, so they'll be posted up on the website, which is really kind of cool. You can go back and check them all out. In closing, I'd like to thank Katie and Buster tonight. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on step 4 from tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Plaza del Sol. It's down Colonial Avenue at 22nd Street before you get to the railroad tracks. So please come out and join us tonight. And I need someone to volunteer to read the last two paragraphs on page 164. Yes.
Hi, my name is Pete. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Pete.
Hey, Pete.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you.
Please feel free to come up and thank the speakers tonight before you leave. And we thank them again. And if you'll help me close with the Lord's Prayer.
For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever.